Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ringnauts and Vognolators, get ready. The Ring Cycle has come back to town. The folks at the Lincoln Center Festival have invited Russia's Kirov Opera, under the direction of Valery Gergiev, to present their Russian version of this four-part, 16-hour German opus. And so we got curious. What's the big deal? Why do Wagner's operas generate so much hysteria? To answer that question, we thought we'd play you an excerpt of the WNYC radio documentary, The Ring and I.
So, what is The Ring? If I had to describe it in one sentence, it would go something like this. The Ring is a German romantic view of Norse and Teutonic myth influenced by a Greek tragedy and a Buddhist sense of destiny, told with a sociopolitical deconstruction of contemporary society, a psychological study of motivation and action, and a blueprint for a new approach to music and theater. But we'll get to all that. The first thing to know about Wagner's Ring is that it is an event. Productions of The Ring Cycle happen all over the world at different times, but here in New York, it seems to roll through about once every 4 years, like the Olympics. And when it does, the air changes. People's eyes dilate, and ring classes, like this one at Juilliard, are practically standing room only.
Okay, so let's begin the serious part of the class.
This is Professor John Muller. He stands by a piano and surveys the 40 or so mostly older Wagner lovers who were lucky enough to make it into his seminar.
And I'm going to start with a quote, and it may seem like an odd way to begin this class, but when the third installment of the Lord of the Rings trilogy came out, they were doing a showing of all three of them. They referred to this as the Trilogy Tuesday. And the author of the article in the Times made the comment about, you know, the need to see all three of them together. He says, "Shouldn't all three movies be watched together? Our forebears had Wagner's Ring Cycle. We have Peter Jackson's Tolkien trilogy." I took offense to this statement.
With a theatrical flourish, Professor Muller flings the newspaper article away from him in disgust, almost hitting a student.
Sorry about that. The Ring is still very much with us, and I don't think it's something just for our forebears, and that statement really bothered me.
Nonetheless, one of the reasons I, and I would guess many people, are curious about Wagner's Ring now was because of the Lord of the Rings connection.
The Lord of the Rings really could not have existed in the form that we know it now without Wagner as an example.
According to New Yorker music critic Alex Ross, there are the superficial connections, like the way the characters dress.
And also a lot of the language, particular Wagnerian phrases, a line like, "Ride to ruin and the world's ending."
And those similarities, he says, can be chalked up to ancient Norse mythology, where both Tolkien and Wagner got their stories, but Wagner threw something new into the mix, which Tolkien borrowed outright. A ring.
This is the main connection, this notion of this object, which gives you power and yet ultimately makes you powerless. Ultimately, you are enslaved to it.
Yes, the ring is very much with us. And, you know, there are people who travel all over the world going to ring cycles. And I don't know, maybe some of you are those people. It's like the people who travel all over the world going to solar eclipses, wherever they may happen.
We're talking about four operas here, or one opera in four parts, and it's 20 hours in all. But it's more than that, too, which was clear from John Muller's class. Like a Hobbit convention or a Grateful Dead tour, a ring cycle is an event. It's a happening. It takes planning. So you'll need provisions. That's why we head to Fairway. Fairway is Manhattan's biggest grocery store, and when there's a ring in town, it's where you'll find Manhattan's biggest ring fan.
Fred?
Yes.
Hey.
Hi.
Jad, nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you.
Fred Plotkin. He writes about food and opera, and, get this, is on his 38th ring cycle.
This year, I'll be seeing three ring cycles in different places. I'm going to two at the Met with different casts, and then I'm going to one in Finland. My idea in creating a menu to dine while watching all four Ring operas is to be thematic with the Ring and inspired by the Ring. And I decided to look at the cycle and look for gastronomic cues, of which there are so many throughout the Ring cycle, of foods, of food products.
He calls this the Wagner meal cycle. He's able to tell the entire story of the Ring through food, and that's why we're here. For sustenance, A.
I take doggy bags when I attend performances and eat them at the intermissions.
And B, because the plot of the Ring cycle can get complicated fast, and this is an easy way to remember what's happening on stage. So Fred begins how the Ring cycle begins, with gold, which we find at Fairway in the chocolate aisle.
John, Duyorti are essential to the Ring cycle because these are little gold-wrapped nuggets of chocolate. They're like currency, but shaped like bricks of gold.
The first opera, The Rheingold, begins underwater, at the bottom of the Rhine River. We see three Rhine maidens swimming around. They guard the gold. And all is fine with the world, says Fred, while the gold stays there.
That's the fundamental thing of the Ring cycle. When it's stolen, theft, and it's given away like taxes to the rich, what happens is everything goes askew. And therefore, we try to put the gold back in the Rhine. It takes 20 hours to do it.
But for the moment, what we see on stage are Rhine maidens swimming, shimmering gold. And what we hear is the orchestra building around one E-flat chord. And this is where things get interesting. As John Mahler tells his class, this may be more than just pretty water music.
In one sense, the opening of the prelude is showing you the Rhine River. From the very depths of the Rhine, when you get the opening E-flat in the double basses, then to higher levels and more activity with arpeggio figures in the strings. But on a much deeper level, Wagner's giving you creation itself. And he represents this by using the overtone series. In other words, we have, in a sense, the creation of tone from one pitch.
The birth of an entire universe, as told in music, note by note, atom by atom. Which is why Professor Mahler tells his students, when they're in the audience during this scene, they may want to close their eyes.
It's going to burst out after more than 3 minutes, and you get the first Rhine maiden entering, Voglinda. And initially she sings a couple of nonsense syllables until she actually starts to speak the words of the opera. So it's as if Wagner is also trying to convey the creation of speech.
This is just one indication that Wagner's approach to drama is pretty wild. On stage, the eyes in our head are seeing Rhine maidens swimming, while the eyes in our ears are getting another image, the cosmos being born. And perhaps Wagner meant for our mind to somehow blend the two. The question remains, though, how do you even get the first part right? The visuals. This is opera, remember, so along with music, we've got the problem of staging.
The Ring is the biggest project, I think, that any opera house faces, always.
This is Joe Clark, the Metropolitan Opera's technical director, and we're on stage during a changeover.
There's a challenge there that I don't think is like anything else.
To our right, 4,000 empty seats. To our left, 60-some-odd workers swing hammers and push props. And to my dismay, for the swimming Rhine maiden scene, he says they don't use an aquarium.
It's certainly not realistic water by any means. In fact, it's very stylized, but the whole proscenium is filled with a number of moving gauzes that are painted to look like water. They're constantly in motion, and there are smoke and dry ice effects operating at the same time with fans. So again, it sort of seems like currents underwater.
And the three Rhine maidens, meanwhile, Joe has them stand on three separate stage lifts, which move up and down.
But very slowly, so you get that sense of water flowing.
We'd heard that the Seattle Opera takes it a bit further, so we called director Spate Jenkins. His company has taken the Rhine maidens to new heights, literally. They suspend the singers 25 feet off the ground.
Well, it looks like Cirque du Soleil is what it does. The first time I saw it, I almost dropped. Because, you see, first of all, we dress them in kind of mermaidish type things and wonderful wigs. It looks as though it's a very fluid and easy movement. They can go down. In other words, they can go down and they can spin. Now, what makes it unusual is that they do, in fact, flip as they sing. The three young women at first were, you know, a little bit nervous about it, but as we moved on into rehearsals and got to the performances, they flipped all the time as they sang. They would flip on singing high notes.
This voice right here is where the trouble starts. This is Alberic, the evil dwarf. He shows up at the bottom of the Rhine, starts to chase the Rhine maidens round and round. They laugh at him, but then he steals their gold and forges a ring that will make him master of the universe. Eventually, the gods steal it from him, and the world begins to go sour. But Wagner's musical universe really starts to take off.
And you can hear the rest of The Ring and I tonight, starting at 8 o'clock here at 93.9 WNYC. The documentary was produced by Jad Abumrad and Aaron Cohen. The Lincoln Center Festival is presenting the Kirov Opera's production of the complete Wagner Ring Cycle twice, this weekend and next week. And that's going to do it for today's show. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, journalist Catherine Lanfer served as co-host of the Al Franken Show in the beginning days of Air America. She joins us to talk about a different but equally wild experience, living for 5 days at a rock and roll fantasy camp, which included things like singing backup for Roger Daltrey. There are many ways to listen to Soundcheck. You can hear archives and podcasts at WNYC.org, and you can check out the comments feature on our website as well. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. Our engineer today was Damon Whittemore. The program is produced by Brian Wise, Joel Meyer, and Allison Lichter with Alicia Abbott. Our senior producer is Gisele Regatow, and our executive producer is Chris Bannon. We had help today from James Williamson, Matt Schultes, and Chris Lim. I'm John Schaefer. Be with us again at this time tomorrow for the next Soundcheck.